Hey, it's Melissa from Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600, and thanks for checking out the podcast right here. If you want, you can always subscribe, share, and like it. Hope to see you guys soon. Thanks.
This is Southern Connecticut's news and information leader, Aurora Communications.
WICC Bridgeport.
8 minutes after 11 o'clock, my name is Greg Lohr. I'll be here till 2 o'clock in the morning. And it's KB, Kevin Broadbent. Here's Eddie Schwartz on WICC. We've got some good music coming up in the next 60 minutes. Rod Stewart, we've got Foreigner, and Neil Diamond all coming your way on WICC, your number one radio station.
And welcome back. Of this, a talk of the town.
Johnny Simple, Mr. Baseman, the unsung hero of rock and roll. Now warned for Vinnie Roberts, 8 minutes after 9.
Yeah, you're hearing from some of the greatest, and even our own Al Warren, who is still here on WICC. Good morning. It's a really special day here at our station. Why? Well, for many of you, you probably know. It's a very, very big birthday at WICC 600. We are 95 today. We are 95 years young. Yeah. It's pretty remarkable. One of the longest standing, oldest talk radio stations still in the state of Connecticut. WICC was Bridgeport's first radio station and one of the first in the state, signing on the air on November 8th back in 1926. It's amazing. The call letters stood for Industrial Capital of Connecticut. That's the WICC. And it really described Bridgeport during that time, the early and mid 20th century. It's really remarkable. It's interesting what WICC has gone through, the shows, the programs, the talent that has come through the doors of WICC over the generations and the decades. And I know it's amazing now at 95 and hopefully at their 100th birthday in 5 years. The team that especially makes up the morning show, both myself and Christian, we have been following WICC since we basically could walk. I know in our own household, my father has it synced to his alarm clock. So as soon as the 6 o'clock hour came about and I was of the age of 4 or 5 years old, WICC came on. That was the first thing I heard every morning since I was about 4 or 5 years old. And I remember being an intern my freshman year of college, and I remember being offered to intern at WICC to do their commercials and work with their creative director. And I just thought, this can't be real. It was the most surreal thing ever. And I remember talking to Chris Marker at that time and saying, you know, I'd love one day to be on WICC. And he said, listen, it is filled with a lot of legends. They don't want to go anywhere. So good luck. We'll see what happens. And, you know, lo and behold, 10 years later, after I was out of college, I landed the morning show. And it's just been this incredible ride. And as I mentioned, it's been such a blessing to also work with someone who is, to me, I call him a super fan of WICC. I mean, this guy knows more about WICC than just about anyone I've ever spoken to. And he still is in touch with so many of the talents who have come through the doors here, are still here. And that's our own Christian, who is behind the board each and every morning of the morning show. And I wanted Christian to pop on a little bit and to just talk about the legacy of WICC, because I just honestly, Christian, I can't think of somebody better to talk to this morning. So good morning. Thank you so much for taking the time to chat about it and get off the board for a quick second. I appreciate it.
Good morning, Melissa. Thank you.
So, Christian, first of all, when did you start listening to ICC?
Well, to answer that question, I want to quote Al Warren, who has a famous saying on his Saturday program. We are the station that entertains you, your folks, and your folks' folks. So my grandparents were lifelong WICC listeners. In turn, my parents were lifelong WICC listeners. Passing that tradition along to me, that was what I listened to before the bus came. Every school day, I listened to the morning show. I listened to the midday show. Afternoons, not so much because I was doing homework. But Al Warren on Saturdays, the house party on Sundays, this was always on at home.
Mm-hmm.
And it,
I mean, for you, Christian, also, you were one of those people who at a very young age, you would go to the events and meet the talent, right? That was something that was like, that was glory for you.
I think that I was just sharing this story with you. I remember the first time I met talent from WICC back in 2002. And I couldn't believe it. And the next day, I remember going on the WICC website, which was, you know, very pre-modern to what we have now. And, you know, the picture was all fuzzy, but my picture was there with this certain person. And at 2002, at 10 years old, it was a big deal. Mm. And at seven, as you know, at 7 years old, I fell in love with radio. And that is what I've always wanted to do. And so meeting someone who had the job that I wanted made me feel like I had a shot one day.
Mm.
And as you said, so many years later, I just am so glad to be working at the station I've always wanted to work at.
Mm-hmm. I mean, and talk a little bit, Christian, because you've followed it for almost three decades now. The changes that ICC has gone through, I mean, it has been incredibly significant. And, you know, you've worked with our engineers, you've watched the changes happen, you've seen some of the greatest, I'd say, on the air come in here and represent ICC. What would you say are some of the biggest changes you've seen over the years?
Ooh, that's a hard question.
Yeah, it's crazy, right? Yeah.
It's gone through, you know, some talent changes. I see that we have Bill getting ready to do the weather. I remember when Bill had a staff of meteorologists.
Mm.
And, you know, back, you know, in some of the older days, Bill and I were reminiscing about Phil Berkowitz, David Plotkin, Michael Thomas, all the meteorologists under his staff. You know, Bill is obviously stretched thin now, but we still have him all these years later. What does that say about him? We still have Kelly after, oh God, 13 plus years.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, just remembering the stories, Melissa, they're going to be telling stories about you and me one day. I'm going to just relate to you before we go a quick story that I happen to hear that. For people who don't know, I'm in one studio, Melissa's in another. We call that the talk studio. Years ago, probably the late 90s, a woman in the employ of the local cleaning company came in to clean the talk studio. And the gentleman running the board, while Becky was giving the news, happened to pot up the talk studio. So on the air, you hear, do-do-do-do-do-do, W-I-C-C, and I'm saying, is that a vac? You know, the certain person who told me the story goes, is that the vacuum on the air? So it's just, there are a lot of memories with this station.
Yeah, there really are.
Thank you, Melissa. I really enjoyed that. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome, Christian. No, I appreciate it. Again, Christian, as many of you know, works behind the board here on the morning show and, you know, makes a lot of the magic happen. And he is just one of the many, 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 many members who have been, as I mentioned, a huge part of WICC's success. 95 years young this morning. It's really quite incredible. And again, it's just such a major blessing to be able to be here with all of you every single day, working side by side with literally some of the greatest. You know, you mentioned people like Bill and Kelly, who I've heard for so long. I mean, I remember being a kid knowing, I don't know if I'm going to be in radio or television or a newspaper. I don't know what I'm going to do. But man, if I could work with someone like Bill Jackman, who to me is the greatest weatherman, and I've worked with plenty. He is just the most accurate, down to earth. And now that I get to work with him every day, it's crazy. It's absolutely amazing. And it does speak volumes for WICC. So as you're going about your day today, please remember it is a huge milestone for your favorite radio station this morning. 95 years. Happy birthday, WICC. So November is Pancreatic Cancer Awareness Month. And actually last week, right at the start of November, the city of Norwalk and New Vans Health decided that they wanted to do a new initiative. It's called Light the City Purple. And it's this very cool thing that they're doing. It allows you to, for businesses and residents to basically have a purple light shining for the month of November to bring awareness to pancreatic cancer. It's very cool. It kicked off on November 4th. I'm sure you could still get involved with it. And it's sort of prompted me to want to dive a little bit more into pancreatic cancer. So I contacted Norwalk Hospital And this morning we are connected to Dr. Richard Frank, who is the chair of cancer research for New Vance Health and the medical oncologist at Norwalk Hospital. Dr. Frank, thanks for coming on this morning.
Thank you very much for having me.
So first and foremost, I think let's just address, what is pancreatic cancer?
Pancreatic cancer is a very aggressive form of cancer, typically that affects the pancreas, which is an organ in the back of the abdomen that makes digestive enzymes. It also makes insulin. It's critical for proper functioning and digestion of food and metabolism. And like every organ, it can undergo degeneration and turn into a cancer, which typically affects people at the average age of around 68, but some individuals can be as young as 40. And it affects about 60,000 Americans every year, as going to be the third highest. It is the third highest cancer in mortality. So unless it's caught early, and it is often not, it is lethal. And that's why we have a great focus on it for research and early detection.
Why is it so hard to catch it early?
Well, for one, there is no blood test. And in fact, the only blood test for a cancer that we know of is prostate cancer, is a PSA. But in terms of catching cancers early for screening, of course, colon cancer, you can do that with a colonoscopy. Breast cancer with a mammography, even lung cancer with a lung cancer CT for people who have smoked. But for pancreatic cancer, it's not practical to image the abdomen with a CAT scan or an MRI. Of course, you can't do that across the population. So you have to figure out which patients are more at risk and then focus on those folks to do a screening effort and to develop an early detection. And that's what we're doing. We have two trials, clinical trials, that are fully supported for patients or individuals who have a very significant family history of pancreatic cancer, for example, in a mother, father, grandparents, brother, sister, or if they have a BRCA gene mutation, that's a hereditary gene mutation, predisposes to ovarian, breast, prostate, and other cancers. And a second for individuals who are over 50 and have new onset diabetes. That's the one finding that is a early symptom of pancreatic cancer that is being increasingly recognized. And we're trying to capture someone who's over 50 who all of a sudden develops diabetes, and especially if they're losing weight, because that's atypical. And so those two populations are who we're focusing on to get an early detection test.
So that's really interesting, and that certainly can be very life-changing. First and foremost, before we continue on, if someone falls under the categories you just talked about, Dr. Frank, do they just reach out to Norwalk Hospital or apply, or, like, how do they do that?
Call 203-855-3551. That's our pancreatic cancer early detection program. Or they can go online and just search for pancreatic cancer screening at Norwalk Hospital.
So we're talking to Dr. Richard Frank. He's the chair of cancer research for New Vance Health, and he's a medical oncologist at Norwalk Hospital. And we're talking about pancreatic cancer. You said, Dr. Frank, that it is one of the more lethal cancers, unfortunately, and I would imagine it's because it's hard to detect early on. So when you get that diagnosis, that it just doesn't look good. I'm curious if there's any, first of all, let's start with, before we even get to signs or symptoms, are there ways that you can prevent pancreatic cancer?
The major risk factors that affect almost every cancer that we know of, quite frankly, are smoking, being obese, low, you know, being sedentary, all the things that make for bad health in general. They are all mild risk factors, but there's not one major risk factor that we know of that you can prevent.
Wow. So I would think it's very crucial if you do have somebody in your family who's had pancreatic cancer. I would think that's at least something that you should be like, okay, so for example, if you have somebody who's listening right now and their grandmother unfortunately died of pancreatic cancer, let's just say, I mean, because there's no screening per se, like, what do you do to try to catch it early or do something, you know, like, when should they start looking into this or talking to their doctors about it?
Right. Well, I mean, the first thing is to recognize that it's 60,000 people get pancreatic cancer as opposed to over 200,000 for the more common cancers. So most of the time, if someone has a symptom, abdominal discomfort, it's not going to be pancreatic cancer. But I think the important thing is, if you develop any kind of abdominal symptom that doesn't go away and it's not consistent with a previous diagnosis, irritable bowel or inflammatory bowel disease, if there's no clear explanation, then you should push the doctor to maybe image and make sure there's nothing wrong. Because one of the things that happens with a pancreatic cancer patient is they repeatedly go back to the doctor over the course of a year for non-specific digestive issues that just don't go away. They're unexplained, and finally a scan is done, and voila, you've got something sitting there. It's a cancer. It's not always the case, but again, anything unexplained, push for an explanation. The second thing is, if there is some remote history in the family, even, make sure you check for diabetes once a year, get an annual physical. That's very important. And make sure that the glucose is under control.
Dr. Frank, we appreciate you giving us all this information. Again, if anybody does want to be involved with the clinical trial that you guys are doing right now, how do they reach out?
203-855-3551. Or go to New Vance Health Pancreatic Cancer Screening.
All right. Well, Dr. Frank, we appreciate all the work that you do and all the folks there at Norwalk Hospital. Thank you for your time this morning.
Thank you. Thank you for helping us spread the word.
Absolutely. First Select woman Brenda Kupchick is here of Fairfield. Good morning, Brenda. Thanks for being here.
Good morning, Melissa.
So this was a pretty disheartening story. I was very shocked, but at the same time, honestly, Brenda, this isn't just something that's gone on in Fairfield. I hate to say it's going on all across Connecticut. And it's very confusing to me why there's such pushback from one side over another in addressing youth crime. In Fairfield, for anyone who missed the story, a 15-year-old has been charged for stealing a vehicle with a group of other juveniles and then going on a crime spree and then ending basically by robbing two women at gunpoint. This was at the Southport School. Around 7:30 in the morning, two school employees were walking into work on Main Street when the teen reportedly approached them, displayed a handgun, and demanded they turn over their phones and their bags. I mean, it's crazy. It's crazy, Brenda, that this kind of stuff is going on, but youth crime is a problem. It's been a problem. So, I mean, it just seems like it's crazy. When I read that, it's crazy.
Yeah, so the chief calls me and tells me what happened that morning. And obviously, it's shocking to think that this happened in our county. But we've been seeing this throughout the state, right? We see these reports, and now it's become sort of a partisan issue between the two parties up in Hartford regarding juvenile justice laws. And honestly, I don't know why that is, because it's very obvious that there's a problem. So this 15-year-old who brandished a weapon to two teachers walking into school, and thank God the kids weren't there yet, has a record, has a long record. A 15-year-old has a long record of crime and was apparently on probation. So I'm not understanding why there is not more consequences, right? So why isn't our legislature, and actually after this incident happened, I called on the governor publicly to please bring back the legislature for a special session. Mm-hmm. And this should not be partisan. The legislature should be discussing opening up these laws, looking at them, talking to law enforcement, looking at the evidence of increased juvenile crime and what is going on here and how can we fix it. We need some consequences. I'm not saying you should throw a juvenile in prison, but if a juvenile is committing a crime with a weapon, a loaded gun, I mean, there was a 14-year-old shot recently mm-hmm. by a juvenile. These kinds of things are escalating, and if the legislature doesn't take action, I can't see how it's going to improve. So that's my call on the governor to call for a special session, because now we've had this happen in Fairfield, and frankly, our residents are very concerned about it.
For good reason. I mean, I have heard directly from people like Senator Bob Duff, who's not far from Fairfield, say that, first of all, the kind of crime that we're talking about, he has said, quote, that Republicans are trying to scare people. that this is still, these are things that have been going on in our inner cities for a long time. And when you compare Connecticut to other states and major cities, we're leagues better. What would you say to those comments that, A, the crime doesn't exist outside of our cities, and B, that just because Connecticut is much better off than places like maybe Chicago, it's not really an issue?
It's simply not true. The police, the Connecticut Police Chiefs Association just came out with a survey. I don't know if you saw it last week. And they are talking about how they have increased crime across the board, especially with juveniles. So I don't know where there's a disconnect between what the senator is saying. And listen, I've worked with the senator in the past. We co-chaired committees together and worked together. But the bottom line is the facts are the facts. We have increased crime, and it should not be the Republicans are saying something or the Democrats are saying something. Look at the facts. Look at what we're doing. We used to have juvenile centers where if a young person was involved in multiple crimes and you saw they're heading down a bad path, there was somewhere for them to go. Now it's just send them back home. And that's not a consequence. It's not good for the public. It's not good for the juvenile, who obviously needs some assistance. Now, I know we have intervention programs, but at some point in time, there has to be a real consequence, because if you think you're not going to be detained or get in trouble for an offense, you're going to keep doing it. So there, I just think there's a disconnect. The Connecticut Police Chiefs Association was very clear. There was a survey out recently about how they feel crime has increased. So there you have it.
Yeah, we have First Electwoman Brenda Kupchick here. And Brenda, I don't disagree with you. I don't understand why this is a party issue. I had Governor Lamont on a couple weeks ago after you had mentioned the 14-year-old who was shot and killed in the back of the head. Governor Lamont came out and said, you know, we've got to do better as a state, which already sort of annoyed some people because we've seen horrific crime sprees happening where someone gets behind the wheel of a stolen car and runs down an innocent jogger. We've had, you know, we had two people who abducted an elderly woman, took her car and abused her, threw her somewhere and lit the car on fire. I mean, for over a debit card, and people who, as you mentioned, have records. And when it was brought to the attention, hey, we need to do more, I asked the governor, so why don't we go into session? I got to imagine now that you're bringing attention to it, we're going to go into session. And he said, I don't see the point in a special session. What can we accomplish in a special session that we're not already doing? And that, I have to be honest, that kind of confused me. So, like, could you maybe tell me what, because to me, I feel like obviously there are some gaps here that we would be able to hammer out in a special session. But the governor's saying he doesn't know why that would be necessary to have a special session.
Well, I served in the legislature for almost 10 years, and I know that the leaders have been meeting. There were some meetings that the leadership on both sides of the aisle were working or discussions about our current juvenile justice law. Yeah, they can happen in a special session. They can be reviewing these ahead of time and then come in and make changes. Listen, the legislature sets the laws, and yes, does it matter? Yes. The special session would help. So I thought that the governor was moving a little on this. He seemed to be, especially after that 14-year-old was shot, that he was kind of, moving toward that direction, being more open-minded, having them come in. Listen, that young man or that juvenile who pulled that weapon on our two teachers in Southport went on to Norwalk and committed an attempted carjacking. So This is a serious issue, and I believe the legislature should go into special session, and it should not be partisan. This is crime, and it's making our state less safe.
First Electwoman Brenda Kupchick is here this morning, and we were talking about crime, youth crime, and how to tackle it in Connecticut, especially after a pretty scary situation happened in Fairfield just a couple weeks back. Brenda, really quick before we switch gears, I have talked to your police department specifically in Fairfield, and Lieutenant Perez has made it a point that part of the reason youth crime has gotten so bad is because police are sort of limited in doing their jobs. They, you know, once they arrest the individual, like you said, they just sort of give them a slap on the wrist and that's the end of it. And a lot of times they'll watch these teens walk out of the parking lot kind of being like, huh. I'll see you again. Didn't really mean anything, but I'm sure I'll run into you again, officer. Any comment on that? If police are not able to do their jobs as well as they used to be able to because of the climate around police and law enforcement?
Well, I think it's dual, right? So it's part of the laws. They can't listen. They enforce the law. So they catch someone committing a crime. They bring them in. They catch them. They book them. And then if the justice system is hamstrung by certain laws, they're back on the street. So according to our police, and I interact with them a lot, it's a catch and release. It's a revolving door. It's the same. It's constant. They're coming back. So our police can only enforce the laws on the books. Mm-hmm. They can't just make up the law. So this has a lot to do with the Justice Department, the justice laws, and how they're consequences are enacted. But yes, I mean, there's a lot of things that prevent our police. I mean, certain things, for example, you know, we've had, and I know other towns have had this, where young people are driving, you know, not street legal vehicles, you know, ATVs and dirt bikes all up and down. We had this repeatedly happen over the summer down our post road while people are walking and crossing. And there is literally like between 20 to 40 of these ATVs and dirt bikes just driving down the street and causing mayhem, and the police can't chase them, right? Because they're not allowed to. That's one of the
right
police accountability bills. Now, our residents get very upset. I get flooded every time that would happen. I would get flooded with messages from our residents saying, why aren't the police doing anything? We're so angry. The police were right there. The police cannot chase them. They're not allowed to do that. And I get why they're not allowed to, because it could cause more problems. It could cause, you know, people to be hurt in the pursuit of that. But at the same time, people need to understand the laws. So, again, the police can only enforce what laws are on the books and what parameters that they are governed by. So there's a lot of things we need to look at. Because it's become a bit lawless, right? Here are two teachers walking into a school. I mean, in Southport, by the way, it's not right off the highway. In Southport, and a 15-year-old has the wherewithal for them. I mean, you know, it's getting out of hand.
Yeah, and it certainly is something that I know we've talked to, as I mentioned, the governor about, and maybe, you know, hearing another call, a local call from somebody like you would kind of get the ball rolling, we would hope. Something else I wanted to chat with you about, Brenda, before we run out of time. I was contacted by somebody who was given an invitation. I believe this person is a local elected public official. And mm-hmm. The concern came from this person in regards to the Fairfield Charter revision. They're supposed to be having a meeting, I guess, tonight, a comment session, rather. And they were only given 2 workdays notice to provide feedback. And the comment here was sort of, you know, why does it seem like we're rushing through this? What's sort of missing here? And you and I have talked a little bit about the drama around the charter mm-hmm. revision. And when I say drama, I don't say that lightly. It's a very, very important document. And it's not to say one side is wrong or right. There's just been a lot around this. And I just wasn't sure if you could give us an update this morning where we're kind of at and the concerns this person is posing, which is that either the RTM is being dismantled, some of the things you and I have talked about before.
Right. So I'm not sure about this 2-day comment. I know, listen, I don't run the charter revision. I appointed the members and the Board of Selectmen voted on them. They did set their schedule for different meetings and what they were going to be doing. And so, for example, I know tonight they are taking input from elected officials throughout our town. Last week, they had department heads and boards and commission chair people or members. So I don't know about the 2-day notice. I know I've been putting these items in my newsletter every week. their website with all their agendas. And so, for example, tonight, like all our department heads couldn't, weren't prepared for last week, but that doesn't mean they can't still provide input. They have been gathering information regarding the charter and how it impacts their departments, and they've been submitting that online through the email, which the charter revision has takes public comment anytime. So, for example, if you sit down and read the charter and then you say, oh, that doesn't work for my commission, or, you know, that hamstrings my department in a way that's not efficient, you can always email the commission. It doesn't necessarily have to be on that specific night, because they're going to be gathering information throughout the year. And so I don't know exactly about what the notice was for whatever the person who reached out to you. But again, tonight's an elected official night. Now, it may be so that not every elected official had time to think about how the charter impacts their ability to in their capacity as an elected official. But that doesn't mean they can't email them next week or the week after or any time throughout this process, because it is an evolving process. I mean, I think it's interesting, and you're right. It's become a little dramatic, and I don't know why. But we haven't had a charter revision review in 15 years, and the state asks towns to do it every 10. And so the bottom line is, you know, obviously I did it before an election. I didn't get to do it. I announced it when I first came in 2 years ago at my State of the Town address to the RTM. And I said I was going to impanel a Charter Revision Commission because it was time. And so, obviously, COVID, we didn't have a chance to do a whole lot else but manage that. And of course, we had arrests and things like that. Town. So I was a little taken off the ball there. But this is something that our town needs. And it's turned, I guess, a little bit sort of I don't know what word to use, like tribalism. Like, you know, the RTM is saying that Brenda's trying to dismantle us, and maybe other groups are saying trying to dismantle this department or that. It's not at all. It's a charter we're supposed to be doing in our town, and we're doing it. And I want everyone to engage in it. I put it in my newsletter repeatedly so that people know about it. They know how to reach out. They know how to provide input. And they know how to listen to it, too, just follow along how it's going.
Well, Brenda, we appreciate that you always come on, and we continue to make clarity with the situation, and we continue to ask questions and be able to talk about it. And I appreciate your extra time this morning. Unfortunately, we have run out, but I know we'll chat again in a couple of weeks. Thank you so much.
All right. It was good to talk to you, Melissa. Have a good day.
You too, Brenda. You too. I don't know if you realized, but November 8th, marks National STEM Day. So STEM, which stands for science, technology, engineering, art, and math. STEAM, if you want to call it that. STEM or EAM. We've seen both ways. And this is really to inspire kids to explore, you know, sciences, engineering. And we've talked about STEM Day. We've talked about STEM research and programs to really help, especially young women, get involved with STEM and to kind of kickstart going into that career path as they get older. And interestingly enough, for National STEM Day today, I'm very excited to have the Mystic Aquarium on for a good reason. Joining me now is Ayana Melvin, who is the Senior Director of Strategic Partnerships at Mystic Aquarium. Ayana, thank you so much for being here. Good morning.
Thank you so much for having me, Melissa. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Yeah. So tell us, the Mystic Aquarium has what's called a STEM Accelerator Program. How long has that been around?
So the STEM Accelerator Program is actually off of another program that we have called STEM Mentoring, funded through the OJJDP, which is about juvenile justice prevention. And we've been doing that for over a decade. So this is a piece of that. And so STEM Accelerator, we kicked into gear to respond to the learning loss that has happened because of COVID-19, and it's a hands-on turnkey program that really gets youth engaged in a fun way to prepare them to go back to school or to prepare them to go into the classroom each day.
Okay, so my understanding, Ayana, and please correct me if I'm wrong, you guys kind of did a big rollout of this over this past summer, correct?
Oh, yeah, we did. So we were lucky enough to get a grant from the Connecticut Department of Education to launch the STEM Accelerator at 10 different locations that are housed at the Boys and Girls Clubs, from Stamford all the way to southeastern Connecticut. And it was fantastic. And also a smaller district, Eastford Public Schools, launched it as well with four different school districts with a program that met youth from K through eighth grade.
Wow. So how many kids were part of the program over the summer?
So we reached about 1,000 youth this summer, which we're really proud of, and they absolutely loved it. So we're also happy about that, too.
Yeah, I mean, let's talk about what the program actually looked like, because as you mentioned, of course, we've heard it from our governor that we had kids fall behind, which we naturally knew was going to happen between distance learning, virtual learning, and just the awkwardness, really, that kids had to be put through with the pandemic. So what did this look like? What does the Accelerator program entail?
Sure. So our model is typically having a group of about 12 youth in one room, and you have them split up into three different groups of four, and there's a mentor with them, or we call them a group lead, and that can be a peer mentor, or it can be an adult, and they work in teams to solve problems and work on fun hands-on activities. And prior to that, they do a little activity. Every single one has like this startup of this warm-up where they get to know each other a little bit, and we call that social-emotional growth. And so we know that that was lost during COVID, like you mentioned. You know, youth are just not together. They're not interacting because of the social distancing. So now this would have them interacting safely and together and problem solving together. So really building back those relationships that are super crucial for them to continue to learn.
That's amazing. So is that going to be basically the same model that we see with this now, with the new, not the new program, but the continuous program, I guess, now this semester?
Yes. Yeah, so we have it rolling out right now. It's already in practice in 12 different locations in Rhode Island, and we want to spread it all over Connecticut. We're hearing great things from our Rhode Island sites, just like we heard from the Connecticut sites, just about re-engaging young people, getting them really pumped up about learning and interested in some of the subject matter, because science, technology, engineering, and math can sound a little boring. And then you also mentioned STEAM, which I'm really happy that you did, which is just art design added to that. So a lot of different programs here in our section of the world do these wonderful programs. But you also mentioned who it engages, and it does engage not only just everybody, but also engages young women and girls. So we're really excited about this rolling out, and we hope that other districts pick it up.
So is this something that they would do like after school, on weekends? How long does the program last? Some of the details behind it, Ayanna.
Sure. So each of the activities run between 30 minutes to 45 minutes. It depends on what age group you're serving. If you're in the K through 5 range, you would serve it and it would be 30 to 45 minutes, and you can do it after school, in the school day, during a summer program, if you have a weekend program. Anybody can operate this, school-based to faith-based to Boys and Girls Clubs, like we mentioned. And so that's kind of the makeup of it. Also, we encourage for the group leaders to bring in middle school age and high school age student to act as that like facilitator along within the room of a professional teacher or an informal educator. So it's great. And so we heard from, you know, our Eastford site that a lot of the older youth took on a leadership role and helped with the smaller kids, but everybody was engaged in learning together. So we really love hearing those things.
That is so cool. So if you have parents, grandparents, aunts, uncles, even teachers this morning who are hearing this going, hey, I have a child or I have a student who I just feel like would love this, would love to be a part of this. Is there an application process or how do they get involved with this? How do they sign up for this?
Sure. So you can go on our Mystic Aquarium page, and there's a section called Learn. STEM Accelerator is right on there, so you can click to learn more about it. We encourage educators, informal and formal, to reach out to their programs or reach out to their schools and encourage them to purchase it. And then we encourage parents and grandparents and anybody else out there to also encourage their cities and towns to invest in STEM Accelerator so that it could be brought to their schools or it could be brought to their churches or it could be brought to their Boys and Girls Clubs or YMCAs, whatever's in the area that serves youth.
That's amazing. Well, Ayanna, we so appreciate you coming on this morning and talking to us about this again. Ayanna Melvin, who is the Senior Director of Strategic Partnerships at Mystic Aquarium, thank you for the work that you guys are doing, and thanks for sharing it on the show.
Oh, yeah. Thank you so much, and happy National STEM Day.
I know. You too. Thank you. Appreciate that.